The government wants to take over my health insurance.
Mine too.
I'm annoyed.
And I'm annoyed.
And we're
a pair annoyed.
Our eyes have seen the gory and the bloody healthcare fight.
And believe in every rumor is America's birthright. Is Obama just like Hitler?
Well, both of their moms were white.
Make sure Fox News is on.
Glory, glory, paranoia. Health reform, it will destroy ya. It's a big socialist ploy. The truth is so far gone. We'll descend on each town meeting, call each congressman a putz. My name's Filbert.
Hazel.
I'm Pecan.
Pistachio.
We're nuts.
Soon health records will be on a chip
implanted in your butt that you'll be sitting on. Health reforms we will resist on. U.S. rankings we've dismissed on. 37th best health system we beat Azerbaijan.
Yeah, I think you're typing that on your TV remote control.
What channel is he on?
Illegal immigrants will get big bags of cash when they are sick.
In the House, Speaker Pelosi's trying every ploy and trick
to persuade those blue dog Democrats. She called in Michael Vick.
Is this healthcare swan song? Glory, glory, new death panels. This will go down in the annals of reasons we should change the channels when our TV is on.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Acts of Sacramento and the Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're listening to Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic, Iran. Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett argue that the U.S. needs to change its policies towards the Iranian government, which is a rational actor that will play a leading role in the Middle East for many decades to come.
Notwithstanding the Islamic Republic's staying power, foreign policy pundits here who in many cases have no direct connection to on-the-ground reality inside Iran, and a cadre of so-called Iran experts, many of whom are expatriates or Iranian Americans whose families fled the revolution and don't want to see the Islamic Republic succeed, these commentators continue to misread and misinterpret Iranian politics, telling us that the system is on the verge of collapse. One of our themes in going to Tehran is that until Americans stop listening to the agenda-driven, fact-free analysis coming from such people, the United States will continue to get its Iran policy wrong and will continue losing ground in the Middle East. A good example of what I'm talking about in this regard came in 2009. When in a collective act of analysis by wishful thinking, American elites focused on former Prime Minister Mir Hossein Mousavi's campaign to unseat incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in that year's Iranian presidential election and on the Green Movement that emerged out of Mousavi's campaign as the key to solving America's strategic problems in the Middle East. American and other Western elites widely anticipated a Mousavi victory when in June 2009 Ahmadinejad won. Those same elites almost universally condemned the outcome as a fraud. They did so even though every methodologically sound poll conducted in Iran before or after the election, including polls conducted by Western polling groups, 14 polls in all, show that Ahmadinejad's re-election with roughly 2/3 of the vote, which is what the official results show that he got, was eminently plausible, and Americans embraced a narrative of election fraud even though neither Mousavi nor anyone else ever presented any evidence of how the election was stolen. This never demonstrated but fervently espoused narrative conditioned American and Western elites' romanticization of the Green Movement, widely portrayed in the West as a mass popular uprising poised to sweep away the Islamic Republic, perhaps within just a few months. But it was evident to anyone prepared to look soberly at reality that even at its height, the Green Movement did not represent anything close to a majority of Iranians, and that within a week of the June 2009 election, the movement's social base was already contracting. But the myth of the Islamic Republic's illegitimacy and instability did not die as a result of the Green Movement's failure. Indeed, it got a new lease on life in early 2011 when the Arab Awakening began. Through the pro-green lens that continues to shape most Western commentary on Iranian politics, it seemed inevitable that the waves of popular discontent, like those that took out pro-American leaders in Tunisia and Egypt, forced a leadership change in Yemen's U.S.-allied government, and seriously threatened another U.S.-allied government in Bahrain, would engulf the Iranian government too. Most of the pundits who had jumped on the regime change bandwagon in 2009 hopped back on for another ride. On February 21st, 2011, billionaire financier George Soros, appearing on CNN's GPS with Fareed Zakaria, offered a bet that, quote, the Iranian regime will not be there in a year's time, close quote. 2 days later, in Foreign Policy, Hillary and I took Soros up on his wager. Now, I recognize the notion of two former U.S. government officials turned university professors betting George Soros on anything might seem a tad absurd, but that's what we did. We even bet that not only would the Islamic Republic still be Iran's government in a year's time, but that the balance of influence and power in the Middle East would be tilted even further in its favor. Almost 2 years have elapsed since Soros made his wager. I have to say we're pretty eager to collect on it. Later in 2011, Western analysts focused on the back and forth between Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the Islamic Republic Supreme Leader, and President Ahmadinejad over the resignation and reinstatement of the intelligence minister and other issues. The same cast of Iran experts, the mainstream media, gave these developments overblown, even hysterical treatment, portraying them as, quote, unprecedented signs of an insecure regime fracturing at the top. Such analyses revealed, at the very least, lamentable ignorance about the Islamic Republic's political history, which since the revolution has been marked by much the same kind of intense competition among elites over policy and power that you see, say, in the United States. Tensions between Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Republic's founding father, and its first elected president, Abolhassan Banisadr, resulted in Banisadr's impeachment during wartime in 1981, after the reformist Mohammad Khatami became president in 1997, his disagreements with Ayatollah Khamenei, who had by then succeeded Imam Khomeini as supreme leader, those disagreements were at least as contentious as the jockeying between Khamenei and Ahmadinejad. In Iran, tensions between elected presidents and the leader are hardly new, and they're not an indicator of systemic crisis. They are politics as usual in a system with multiple power centers and institutionalized checks and balances. But in the fact-free approach of many so-called Iran experts here in the United States, if Iranians display the sort of contestation over policy relative position within their system that virtually everywhere else in the world we call normal politics, then our Iran experts tell us that this is something abnormal and pathological and that the system must be coming apart. It is not. Despite these experiences and other similar experiences, too numerous to lay out here, but that we go through in the book, American political and policy elites continue promoting the idea that of the myth of the Islamic Republic's illegitimacy and fragility. Today, this myth comes in two interlocking versions. One, that sanctions are now finally working to undermine the Islamic Republic's basic stability, and two, that the Arab awakening has left the Islamic Republic isolated in its own neighborhood. On sanctions, Hillary and I have just returned from our most recent visit to Iran last month. We're happy to talk more about current economic conditions, social and political conditions in the Q&A. For now, let me say simply that no one who has walked the streets of Tehran, who has seen that Iran's economy is not collapsing, or who's talked to a range of Iranians, could possibly think that sanctions are working in a way that will compel either the Islamic Republic's implosion or its surrender to American demands on the nuclear issue. That is delusional.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist either.
Yo, we're climate scientists, and there's no denying this. Climate change is real. Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist. Not a Clio finalist, no, a climate scientist. Dropping facts all over this wax. While fitness be crying about a carbon tax. Climate change is caused by people. Earth on like alien has no sequel. We gotta move fast or we'll be forsaken.
Cause we were too busy sucking things in Copenhagen.
Hey, it's hot in here. 32% more carbon in the atmosphere. Oi, oi, oi.
True. Unlike Andrew Bolt, our work is peer-reviewed. Hey! Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist, an Anglican revivalist. No, a climate scientist.
Feedback, like climate change on crack. Permafrost subtracts.
Feedback.
Methane release is whack.
Feedback.
Write a letter, then burn it.
Feedback.
Deny, let's deny this in your dreams. Cause climate change means greater extremes. Heat won't be the norm. Heat waves bigger, better storms.
Greenhouse effect is just a theory, sucker.
Yes, so is gravity. Float away, mother floater.
Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist. A penny farthing cyclist? No, a climate scientist.
A Fox News journalist?
No.
A paleontologist?
No.
A clean coal lobbyist?
No.
A cashed up alarmist?
No.
A climate study scientist? Yo!
Preach.
On the Arab Awakening, the same pundits who say that sanctions are working advise you to embrace the logic-defying proposition that the same social currents that deposed pro-American leaders in Tunisia and Egypt and are empowering Islamists in countries across the Arab world will, in Iran, somehow transform the Islamic Republic into a secular liberal state. That is truly logic-defying. In Tehran, we can tell you Iranian policymakers and analysts see the Arab Awakening as hugely positive for the Islamic Republic's regional position. They judge correctly that any Arab government which becomes at all more representative of its people's beliefs, concerns, etc., will also become less enthusiastic about strategic cooperation with the United States, let alone Israel, and more open to Tehran's message of foreign policy independence. Tehran doesn't need Arab governments to be more pro-Iranian. It just needs them to be less pro-American, less pro-Israel, and more independent. More particularly, one hears in Washington that because of the Arab Awakening, Tehran is going to lose Syria, its quote-unquote only Arab ally, with dire consequences for the Islamic Republic's regional position or even its internal stability. I'll make 2 points on this. First, Syria isn't Iran's only Arab ally today. Syria isn't even Iran's most important Arab ally today. Thanks to President George W. Bush and all those Democrats who supported him after 9/11, the Islamic Republic's most important ally today isn't Syria, it's Iraq. Second point, Iranian policymakers don't believe that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will be overthrown, at least not by Syrians. Assad still retains the support of about half of Syrian society. Even if Assad felt compelled at some point to surrender Damascus, he and his forces would continue to control a significant part of Syrian territory. Under these circumstances, Syria is hardly likely to become an ally of the West. Indeed, any sort of plausibly representative post-Assad government isn't going to be more pro-American or pro-Israel than the Assads have been. Such a government might even be less keen about keeping Syria's border with Israel quiet, and that will be just fine for the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials believe that overall developments in the Middle East are continuing to steer the regional balance in Tehran's favor. As far as the prospects for U.S.-Iranian diplomacy are concerned, Hillary and I think that one of the most dangerous myths promoted by some of America's so-called Iran experts is that the Islamic Republic is so ideologically committed to anti-Americanism, or at least so dependent on anti-Americanism for its domestic legitimacy, that it can't ever seriously contemplate improving relations with the United States. This is thoroughly contradicted by the historical record. As we show in our book, the Islamic Republic has been prepared for decades for better relations with the United States. We're happy to talk about that in the Q&A. But in the Iranian view, this is only possible on a basis of equality and mutual respect, meaning that the United States needs to accept the Islamic Republic. It's the United States that hasn't been willing to deal on this basis. Even under President Obama, his administration has participated in multilateral nuclear negotiations with Iran and used Iran's unwillingness to surrender to U.S. demands in these talks to intensify sanctions, step up covert action, launch cyber war against the Islamic Republic, and come ever closer to regime change as the ultimate goal of American policy. While U.S. officials regularly excoriate Tehran for either playing for time or being too internally conflicted to negotiate seriously, it is Washington that has not been diplomatically serious. Iran has consistently been prepared to accept more intrusive monitoring of, perhaps negotiated limits on, its nuclear activities if Western powers recognized its right to enrich uranium under international safeguards. But President Obama, like his predecessor, refuses to acknowledge Iran's right to enrich. For this would require acknowledging the Islamic Republic as a legitimate political order representing legitimate national interests and as a rising regional power unwilling to subordinate its foreign policy to Washington, as, for example, Washington regularly expected of Egypt under Sadat and Mubarak. This is why Hillary and I say that Obama has done more damage even than George W. Bush, because he has discredited the idea of engagement by saying he tried but failed, when in fact he has not seriously tried.
Then we're going to have time for questions.
Yeah.
We're about 40 minutes.
That's fine. No American president since the Iranian Revolution has been prepared to do this, to accept the Islamic Republic. But, and this is a key argument for us, this is the only way diplomacy can succeed. There is an important precedent for this in modern American history. It's appropriate to call this in the month in which Richard Nixon's 100th birthday falls. Nixon and Kissinger's opening to China. Their great achievement was not that they talked to Beijing. The United States had been talking to Beijing for years in ambassadorial level talks that had gone nowhere. Nixon and Kissinger's achievement was that they accepted and persuaded their countrymen to accept the People's Republic of China as a legitimate political order representing legitimate national interests that the United States, for its own interests, needed to come to terms with. That's what we need to do with the Islamic Republic today. Is Obama going to be up to this in his second term? Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've got about 20 minutes left. I just wanted to ask one question. As I read through your book, Iran, one of the quotes you have, in Iran has never attacked another state or even threatened to attack one. I've got a little bit of experience. I was at West Point on the 21st of January in 1981 when we had dinner with the hostages as they came back, and I think there would be some argument along that regard. I spent 2 years in Afghanistan, and in several of the operations we did, we uncovered caches and weapons that were marked from with Iranian markings, and our assessment was that they had come from Iran. If you look at the 2006 Israeli fight in Lebanon, I think you would have some discussions there about Iranian involvement in that operation. So I hear you that they have not invaded another country, but clearly supporting in other ways, I think, is something that in my short experience I've seen. So I wonder how would you respond to those activities?
Well, I'll go first. I think they're all very important points, and particularly this is something I think that drives the American perception of the Islamic Republic, that is an aggressive state, particularly with the rhetoric or how some of the rhetoric is translated or construed here, that the Islamic Republic is aggressive and particularly aggressive vis-a-vis the state of Israel. You constantly hear that the Islamic Republic of Iran is threatened to annihilate Israel, to wipe it off the map. Clearly, the Islamic Republic of Iran has a bad relationship with Israel. It doesn't accept it. It doesn't accept its way of its political order in terms of how it disenfranchises a large segment of its population, and it is opposed to that. The Islamic Republic also has views in terms of its neighbors and how their orders are that are hostile to Iran. It sees a lot of these political orders as hostile to it. But what we're trying to get across is what Iran does to respond to what it sees as these threats is not to threaten to attack, is not to threaten to invade, and is not to attack or invade. The Islamic Republic has never attacked or invaded any other country. That's not what it does. What it does is something even more powerful, something maybe even more potent vis-a-vis the United States that we can't really compete with as we stay a conventional military power, which is, first and foremost, it develops relationships with groups on the ground. Those relationships have much to do with, and we argue mostly to do with, its soft power appeal, its appeal in terms of Islamist participatory Islamist governance, its independent foreign policy.
And resistance to occupation.
And its resistance to occupation, whether that occupation is Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, or whether that occupation is the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan, essentially, or as it was in Iraq. It does that very, very effectively. But Iran, like other states, Iran under the Shah, other states, also buttresses those relationships with support, whether that's financial support or guns and things like that. But what we are trying to get across is by focusing on that piece, that is a very small piece, and that's not the problem. We can outgun Iran anytime. The U.S. military can project overwhelming conventional military force and crush Iran militarily in any arena. That's not the problem we have with Iran. The problem we have with Iran is their ability to form these deep relationships with groups across the region, from Afghanistan to Egypt. That's what we don't have an answer to. That's what we're saying is dramatically shifting the balance of power. If it were all about who has the most guns, we would be in the great situation that we were in the 1980s and 1990s, where Iran didn't stand a chance. The Islamic Republic had no way to oppose us in the Middle East. But what they've done is they've seized on this political awakening in the Middle East, and they are changing the balance of power in a way that we have no answer to.
Saddam, before you go, I want you to know this whole thing between you and me, it wasn't just between you and me. It's between you and me and my daddy, because you tried to hurt my daddy back in the day, and I don't cotton to that sort of behavior. So my daddy's here tonight, and so's my mommy, and I'm going to put you on speakerphone. Hi, Dad. How's it going, Dad?
Hey, son. Good to see you. You know, son, just like when I was president, war in Iraq, good. Economy, bad. I think I'll call you Mini-Me.
That's right, Georgie. And now there's all these stories going around about how you misused information from the CIA to justify going to Iraq. They said something about you were lacking the proper intelligence.
Well, look, Saddam, the good news is we have control of Iraq.
And the bad news is you have control of Iraq.
Some were saying, where is Saddam?
Now they're saying, where are the bombs?
Found you at last,
down in your trench.
Surrendered fast, so you'd think I was French. A man who's bright would not start this fight,
but someone dumber might.
Wella, 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 tell me, George,
he had weapons of death.
Tell me more,
just my spider whole breath. I was hiding, lived like a mole.
Then like a groundhog, you popped out of your hole.
Saw your shadow, you know what they'd say.
4 more years, a bush on the way.
A man with tact won't stay in Iraq.
But someone dumber might.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Tell me more.
Why did you lose the war?
Tell me more.
Got endorsed by Al Gore.
The case for war, it was so strong.
The case for war turned out so wrong. You made it up, you lied the whole time.
He just stole John Kerry's line.
No one sane will back your campaign.
But someone dumber might.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.